You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. Today's program is brought to you in part by the Santa Fe Opera. The five operas in this 60-second season represent an incredibly wide variety of productions, artistically and emotionally, from hilarious comedy with Rossini's Italian Girl in Algiers to the deepest heartbreak of Madame Butterfly by Puccini, the nuclear threat of our own era with Dr. Atomic by John Adams, and Leonard Bernstein's philosophical musical Candide, and finally, Richard Strauss's tale of decadent parties in Vienna. It's all there at the Santa Fe Opera, santafeopera.org. For more information and tickets, you can call 1-800-280-4654 or locally 505-986-5900. This program is brought to you by Total Wine and More. With locations in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, each store has about 8,000 different wines from all over the world and thousands of beers, including both major brands and microbrews and imported beers. And they have more than 3,000 different kinds of spirits, all at the lowest prices you'll find, and with a trained, knowledgeable staff. They're on the web at totalwine.com, and you can order for in-store pickup. And if you use my promo code, you can save even more. Use code 6979 at the store or online and receive $10 off on your next $50 purchase. That's code 6979. Thanks again to Total Wine and More for sponsoring the Radio Cafe. I'm delighted to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Peter Sellers. He's a world-renowned director. He's the librettist and director of Dr. Atomic, which is at the Santa Fe Opera. The New Mexico premiere is this Saturday, the 14th of July. Welcome.
Oh, hello. It's a thrill to be back.
Well, you were here 10 years ago. You've done a lot of work with the Santa Fe Opera over the years, and I remember we were talking about, will Dr. Atomic, which is about the creation of the atomic bomb, will it ever be in Los Alamos, sightline to Los Alamos from the opera? Now you're here. I'm sure everyone's asking this, but what's it like?
Well, I mean, to say one thing is, you know, during the shows that I've done here in the Santa Fe Opera over the last decade or two, I've always been researching Dr. Atomic. I've always been making little side trips to Los Alamos and always meeting people and trying to, you know, put pieces together and haunting the secondhand bookstores and just trying to, you know, really absorb and prepare materials for this opera. So it's very, very moving that it's finally here. And when you experience this in the night in New Mexico with that sky and with those winds coming through in the second act, it is so haunting. It is so beautiful. It is so appalling. It is so magical, and it's so utterly real. All of those things are going on at the same time, and you're in the heart of the moral crisis of it. You're in the shocking heart of the future of it, which nobody alive in 1945 could have ever imagined, and what we're living in right now. And so it's a very exhilarating experience, because the opera is, you know, the reality of the opera is in this land, in this landscape, and in the veins and arteries of the people on stage, from the Santa Clara Pueblo, from the San Ildefonso Pueblo, from the Tsuki Pueblo, downwinders from Carrizozo, and all around Alamogordo, scientists and people who've been working at Los Alamos, all are on stage, and as well as some pretty fabulous opera singers and some very beautiful dancers. And so the total impact of New Mexico speaking, dancing, and singing is very, very powerful.
You talked about the character of Robert Oppenheimer as a character you can't explain away. I think those were your words. And it's like, what makes an interesting character, not only in real life, but for a drama, for a piece of work like an opera. I mean, he's been described by Richard Rhodes as an operatic character. Talk to us about what your experience of Robert Oppenheimer is ongoing, because you've been working on this for a long time.
Well, obviously, one of the most thrilling things is to be with scientists who are deeply cultured people in the humanities. And so there are people holding all these realms of knowledge, this kind of phenomenal, you know, ability to understand invisible forces in the realms of the physical world. But then when they're also like great string quartet players and poets, you just go, oh my God. And Oppenheimer is one of those people who's at home, you know, like literally with Igor Stravinsky, and that, you know, Stravinsky's Requiem Canticles was played at Oppenheimer's funeral, and probably a lot of Requiem Canticles was written here in Santa Fe. And that Robert Oppenheimer and Igor Stravinsky would hang out. You know, that's pretty astounding. And not only just a cult of genius, but actually people on the front edge of what the possibilities of human existence could be. And really the forefront and imagining things in ways that none of their contemporaries are quite able to grasp. That, combined with the fact that Oppenheimer's vulnerability, the incredible suffering that he went through across his life, the incredible humiliations, the kind of shocking stripping of all of his importance, and absolutely labeling him a traitor and humiliating him, all of this he endured with not just stoicism, but with a kind of a fortitude that takes your breath away, because, you know, that's the actual definition of nobility in African royalty. And what you see in African statuary is the worst day of your life and the best day of your life have to be equal. And you have to respond to them both the same way. With grace, with absolute poise. And you see that beauty of African sculpture, which is just poised, no matter what's going on. And you're not reacting to everything. You're not in a panic. You're not in a sweat. You're actually holding your own against a raging storm. And to see over and over again Oppenheimer's grace under conditions that would have destroyed any lesser person. And at the same time, he's not armor-plated. He's flesh and blood. He's so delicate. He's so finely strung. He's so absolutely vibrating at the most delicate frequencies. And he's in the middle of a moral dilemma that will not be solved. And so he takes you into the realm of Hamlet. He takes you into the realm of Oedipus Rex, where, you know, the person who has knowledge also is the person who is unbelievably exposed and may even, with all of his knowledge, wisdom, superiority, imagination, and nobility, get it wrong. And that getting of it wrong is what the Greeks called tragedy. And tragedy was meant to ennoble human beings. And, you know, we don't really do plays about people who get it right, because, you know, success does not create equality. And I think, you know, the people who are successful are people who you hear them tell you about it, and it's very annoying. And people who have tragedy in their lives, well, that turns out to be all of us. That turns out to be the equalizer, the place at which we all meet. Is the things we didn't do well, we're not proud of, we're beyond our control, and that are going to carry with us for the rest of our lives.
I mean, the way you talk about this man, if somebody were listening and they didn't know that he'd invented a weapon of mass destruction, you wouldn't be able to get that from your words about him. I mean, that moral problem, and I think it's a moral problem that we're all involved with living in the industrial age to some extent. I mean, people invent stuff and it makes us happier, it makes us comfortable, and then there are unintended consequences or consequences that nobody cares about until they get really bad, like climate change or plastic in the ocean or pollution or whatever, and then there is this question of what do we do about that? But with nuclear weapons, it's at a whole other level, and one feels that in the Manhattan Project, you know, doing this because you could do it, doing it because it was a problem to be solved, because it was there on some level. And then the result of that is vaporizing not only human beings, but every other living being in sight. What do you do with that? Have we, to any extent, come to a reckoning with the moral consequences of that?
I think it's fairly well understood that it's a wrong left turn in human history, and we really have to go back and turn the car around and get back on the main road. And the nuclear weapons part of things is a simple mistake. Every single one of them has to be eliminated. And there are, you know, I'm joined by, you know, radicals like Ronald Reagan and George Shultz and Henry Kissinger on that. I mean, it's just truly anybody who's gotten anywhere close to the reality understands that there can be no nuclear war ever. It is not something that you can use or engage in. And every single nuke must be destroyed, eliminated, and there must never be one again. And we have the technical capacity to detect any nuclear activity anywhere in the world and shut it down. And we need, for the history of humanity, simply to make that our agreement and our pact. Any nuclear weapon is a danger to the entire planet. And because error is built in, there's no way you can legislate against it. And of course, earthquakes and, you know, all kinds of things. I mean, look at Fukushima. We're in a situation where it will never be safe in any way, and it will always be lethal at a scale that is just hard even to imagine. The other consequences, which go on and on, are, you know, include, of course, that cancer became the disease of choice after World War II, and a disease that was almost unheard of in the previous decades. And what it means that, you know, the air, the milk, the land, all these things are invaded by not only the more than 2,000 nuclear tests, you know, that have happened since Alamogordo, but the fact that it's part of the texture of our lives now. So the work that has to be done to eliminate it is very, very steep. I mean, it's huge, and yet there is no choice.
It's been compared to eliminating smallpox. You get rid of all of them, every last one is eradicated. And at the same time, I mean, I've been reading about the firebombing of Japanese cities before, and I think even a little one or two after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and that was, I think, like 67 cities, even more death than the two atomic bombs, people being burned, babies being burned alive. I mean, finally all those witnesses came out and talked about what happened. My mother lived through the firebombing of Dresden, and all of this is talked about. I mean, the narrative about nuclear weapons is everything changed, but I also wonder if we should also be thinking about it as a continuum of the other kinds of weapons of mass destruction that are not nuclear, but are every bit as crazy, evil, and kind of inconceivable.
Well, inconceivable. Somebody conceived the uranium-tipped bullet that we use all the time in Afghanistan. I mean, a level of cruelty, a level of, I mean, toxicity, danger, viciousness, that is beyond belief. The design of new weapons, the idea, you know, of napalm even, that, you know, you're going to kill somebody, but you want them, you don't want to just kill them. You want them to die in maximum agony and have a level of incredible suffering in their last hours of life. That's the extra thing that's built into new weapons. And the weapons that were tested, obviously, in the Iraq War on armies and civilians, which suck people's lungs out of their bodies. I mean, just shocking things of, like, who could think of this stuff? People are thinking of it every day, designing it, building it, and using it. And the high end of cruelty of new weapons design, you know, Hiroshima was one moment, but we keep going.
Right. You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We're going to take just a quick break to hear from one of our sponsors. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. As you know, if you're living here in Santa Fe, we had a warm winter and we didn't get enough snow. The snow brings the water we need, and as a result, New Mexico's drought is currently among the worst in the United States. As the summer heats up, water restrictions in Santa Fe will be coming into effect, and we're being called upon to renew our conservation efforts and learn more about what we can do to value our water. Visit facebook.com/SaveWaterSantaFe to take the City of Santa Fe's new drought online quiz and learn not just about the current condition of the drought, but also how to contribute to long-term efforts to maintain a healthy, green, and water-wise Santa Fe. And now back to our program. Women play an important role in the opera, and I think in the context of war, women tend to be second-class citizens. We're not the warriors. We're the helpers or the people who replenish the population when it gets decimated by war. But that's also true in, I think, a similar dynamic of Native people, of civilians, of nature itself. And so there's this whole mentality of a whole group of beings who are essentially feminized and expendable. That's us. And I feel like you're addressing this in the opera and in this production in particular, by bringing these voices and these people into the conversation.
Well, of course, the women's side of atomic history is a few extraordinary women scientists, of course, but mostly wives, and mostly helpful, you know, gals who helped with math and computation, and just secretarial. Of course, the feminist presence, the feminist gift is life itself. So when you're dealing with a culture of mass death, you were also at Los Alamos dealing with a culture of mass baby making.
Right.
And, you know, that they had to, you know, quadruple the size of the creche at Los Alamos, and that all these women from the pueblos had to come and be nannies for this outrageous explosion of babies, so that the same guys who are spending their day in a lab creating mass death come home at night and are holding their little two-month-old child. That kind of, you know, life and death, deep, deep contradiction and yet longing and yearning in the lives of these young scientists and their families, is what we try and put on stage. But we also, of course, are very, very privileged that Santa Clara, San Ildefonso, and Tsuki Pueblo have come together to create a new corn dance to be offered on the stage at the Santa Fe Opera. And every evening begins with that ceremony, a sacred ceremony, a prayer, a dance that does be a to create a healing zone and a healing action and a concentrated, focused, deeply, deeply committed communal healing process. And those dancers come back and dance also in the corn dance in John Adams' opera in the second act. And those ceremonies of life are right up against the ceremonies of death. The ceremonies of death, needless to say, are not long-lived. I mean, they just don't. They are, as they say, unsustainable. And meanwhile, if you're looking at what sustains is, of course, the culture of life. So that's why it's very important when our society is so absorbed with the culture of death to be able to offer the daily alternative, which is the culture of life, which is so much more potent and actually will outlive everything else, because the death is shall we say, self-erasing. And I mean, the moral questions are not gone, but the actual destruction is over, and then bizarrely the earth comes back. Bizarrely, life does continue, and sometimes in new forms, but life itself, you can't actually stamp it out. We are in an era of the culture of war. Those of us who are still committed to the culture of peace have a pretty rich field to work in. And so it's, I would just say that, you know, even though you mention indigenous people and women as expendable, it's actually the only reason the earth is still here, and the only thing that is going to endure.
Your word in dog's ear. But I mean, there is this question that I think your work is addressing, which is, who owns the narrative? Who gets to be heard? What are the stories that are getting heard? Because, I mean, the narrative of, you know, bombing saves lives and stuff that when people say it, my response is, are you insane? You know, I can't even get into a rational conversation along those lines. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And I think that's partly being female or being a certain kind of human or whatever. But this question of who tells the story? I mean, I feel like that's part of what you're working with.
Well, it's one of the beauties of opera, because opera is a collective process. And we're really gathering people. And we're gathering people to listen. And we're gathering people to talk and sing and dance. And that sense that history is not held by individuals, it's held by communities. And that knowledge is not held by individuals, it's held by communities. And in contrast to the image of the lone genius is actually the fact that scientific knowledge exists in a community. That was one of the things that the scientists at Los Alamos resisted so much from the U.S. Army compartmentalization, where, you know, the Army was trying to say, no, these people don't need to know that. And in fact, in science, everyone needs to know everything. It is a community of knowledge, and knowledge is held not by individual geniuses. That's very, very liberating, and of course, it's how we all live, because every idea you've ever had didn't come from you. It came from all the people who you've known, all the people you've been moved by, all the people who've shaped your life. And none of us are shaped by ourselves. We're shaped by all the people around us. So that sense that, you know, everything is actually more porous, everything is more fluid, everything is more interconnected, of course, is the reality. And you can claim something else, but I'm sorry, that really doesn't hold up. And that's the pleasure of what we get to do as artists, and what it means to do interdisciplinary, intercultural, collaborative projects of a certain scale, which invite all kinds of people into the process of creating a story. And in opera, what's really satisfying is, you know, as Alice Goodman, who wrote the libretto for Nixon in China, always said, you know, my Nixon is different from John Adams' Nixon, is different from Peter's Nixon, is different from Jim Madalena's Nixon, who sang Nixon. I mean, by the time all of us have put something into that character has turned into a very rich and amazing phenomenon. And I think that's the beauty of the art form itself, is complexity, layering, contradictions, they're all there.
This opera was first presented in 2005. How has it evolved for you over the many productions since then?
Well, again, the the nuclear issues have only gotten more intense, and particularly with our current administration, you know, commissioning a whole new raft of nuclear weapons, and you know, and having no problem with threatening countries, you know, with, you know, we'll nuke you tomorrow morning for breakfast, and the kind of casual way in which nuclear questions are right now being handled, because again, we all like to think the scientists are to blame for creating these things, but in fact they don't have a voice in using them, and the way they're used is entirely a political question, and it's entirely decisions made by politicians. So when the political structure is as fragile as it is now, and when the kind of sense of government integrity is so seriously weakened, and meanwhile it's the government that is in charge of these weapons and maintaining them, let alone, you know, threatening with them, it's a very serious moment in history.
Well, one of the things you were talking about the other day was the existence of these secretive, undemocratic states within a state kind of thing. And that's, of course, what the Manhattan Project was. That's what a lot of the military is. A lot of other things, too. How are you thinking about that?
Well, that is something we try to put on stage in Dr. Atomic, because Dr. Atomic is the first major moment there's a government inside the government, you know, and huge decisions are made on all of our behalf, and all kinds of people, you know, for generations have cancers, have all kinds of things because of a decision that was made secretly by an individual. And that's not the way democracy is supposed to work. And obviously, you know, we're constantly up against more and more elaborate forms of tyranny in the history of the United States, and more intolerant forms that will not allow a multiplicity of voices, that insist on a top-down narrative and on a command and control approach. The weaknesses of that can be seen, you know, in the history of fascism all over the world. But when it's happening to you, it's how you fight it is a serious question. And, you know, what was it like to be in Germany in 1938-39? As always, you know, the real level of fascism, people vote for it. They actually want it. And it's extremely attractive because it makes the world look simpler than it ever is. And it takes very, very difficult problems and public failures and announces them as victories. And so that's consoling, and it puts your problems at bay for a little while. But of course, anyone who ever put a problem at bay knows what it means, is you've just, everything gets so much worse. If you at least deal with it when the problem comes up, you have a chance. Right. Later on, it just gets so much worse.
Like, so, not dealing with an illness.
Yeah. So we're right now in a complicated situation. And again, what does it take to respond to that level of tyranny with words that have power, with actions that have power, but which also are measured and are not in themselves fascist and opportunistic? And so, you know, that's I think part of the challenge, is because it's, if you're a fascist, you can say anything. And if you're not, you have to speak and be conscious of what you're saying and moderate your language, which is obviously so much less sexy. And so we're in that state right now.
Right.
One of the things that we get to do in opera is reach beyond that, because John Adams' music is sexy. John Adams' music is overwhelming and can say things that you just can't go out and say in public. And suddenly this music says it, and it's thunderous and overwhelming and thrilling and sexy and goes right through your central nervous system and is a giant turn on at the same time as it sets off all the alarms ringing, and you say, wait a minute, we have to deal with this. That's the thrill of working in opera, and that's the amazing thing about working with John Adams.
One of the things you said before about the African approach to treating your best day and your worst day the same. It's funny, I was reading almost word for word the exact same thing in the context of Buddhism this morning.
Yes, of course. Yes.
And there is a kind of like in, you know, Buddhism and Hinduism and a lot of other very deep and fundamentally indigenous traditions, there's this sense of balance. There's always the light, there's always the dark, and keeping those things in balance. And inherent in that way of thinking is not really a sense of progress. It's a sense that sometimes it's light, sometimes it's dark, but it all balances out in the end. Whereas we, I think Westerners or Americans, always have this sense that we are moving towards something a little better, and the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice. And I have been thinking, and I think so many of us have been thinking about these questions of, I mean, is this the last throes of a kind of toxic, life-hating, death-affirming way of being with one another?
Well, I mean, it just, you know, you do have to, as the Dalai Lama says, you have to be grateful for your enemies because they deepen your practice. That is actually what makes the profound moment, is when you're up against very serious opposition. The other, you know, important thing is, you know, Jesus is, Father, forgive them, they don't know what they do, is, you know, did he get mad? Did he say, oh my God, why am I have to go through this? It's quite the opposite. If there had been no crucifixion, there would have been no Christianity. So the idea that the big disappointment and the catastrophe, where the thing that you thought was going to change the world gets shut down and eliminated by, you know, a hostile dictator, and suddenly the person who you thought would transform the world is buried as a criminal, which is how Christianity started, you know, that you have to remember those reversals are really necessary. And the yin-yang of it is extreme and very painful, but also builds strength, builds an ability to endure, builds a sense that we're here for a longer-term purpose, moves against selfishness. You can't drown yourself in self-pity, because there are people whose situation is way worse than yours, and you need to be there for them. And you need to be active, and you can't be smug. And none of the answers are easy. And you're in a place where if you have something exceptional, amazing, a gift, an insight, some kind of thrilling power, you have to reach and find it now. So it's an incredible time to be here.
Peter Sellers is director and librettist of Dr. Atomic, which premieres its New Mexico premiere at the Santa Fe Opera this Saturday, July 14th. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh my God, what a pleasure. Thank you so much. Again.
Again. May there be future
yes.
meetings as well.
We insist.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.